From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Kamala Harris becomes the official Democratic candidate for president, much to the delight of many Florida Democrats.
She doesn't just think of herself, she thinks about me, you.
Also this week, is Governor Ron DeSantis' political clout beginning to wane? We'll have some analysis in that regard.
The legislature just does not buck at the governor's office the way that it did in kind of a different era of Florida politics.
We'll also investigate the financial cost of abortion in Florida in light of the state's more restrictive law. And if you think the Paris Olympic Games were exciting, you gotta check out the upcoming Paralympics. I'm Tom Flanagan. Online and on air, this is Capitol Report and the end-of-week wrap-up of top stories from Tallahassee. Before we get this week's Capitol Report underway, some breaking news. A former Okaloosa sheriff's deputy who shot and killed an Air Force senior airman in his own home has been indicted on manslaughter charges. Former Deputy Eddie Durant shot Airman Roger Fortson multiple times in May after Fortson opened the door of his Fort Walton Beach apartment while holding a gun in his hand that was pointed toward the ground. Durant was responding to a call of a domestic dispute from the apartment complex and came knocking on Fortson's door. The airman was alone at the time. Democrats across Florida are showing their support for Vice President Kamala Harris. She accepted the Democratic presidential nomination Thursday, becoming the first woman of color to ever do so. Adrian Andrews sat in at a Democratic watch party to grab Democrats' reaction to the historic moment.
I accept your nomination to be president of the United States of America.
Harris became the first Black and Indian woman to accept a major party presidential nomination. She received a standing ovation from members of the Democratic Party, both in person and online. The Florida Democratic Party held watch parties across the state for Harris supporters who couldn't make the convention. 19-year-old Jaden D'Onofrio attended the party in Tallahassee.
I've never seen the Democratic Party so aligned and so united.
Jaden is a voting rights advocate and chairs the Florida Future Leaders PAC. He attended the DNC watch party to show his support for Harris, and he says to send a message to young people in Florida.
Youth want to get involved. They're seeing the opportunities to get involved. Students for Harris is a great coalition within the campaign that's really energizing youth, and I only expect that to grow.
The president of the Democratic Club of North Florida, Jawanda Beck-Jones, says she's voting for Harris because
she doesn't just think of herself, she thinks about me, you, and so we need her.
State election officials expect an increase in voter turnout this November, and after years of Republican leadership in Florida, state Democrats are hoping the Harris-Waltz enthusiasm will trickle down the ballot.
Everything is possible in this election. We are seeing the polls significantly even change with Kamala Harris, the top of the ticket. That is why we filled every House, every Senate, every congressional seat with Kamala Harris, the top of the ticket, Ron DeSantis underwater, the legislature underwater, the issues that are mattering to the people they are on the wrong side of.
Florida Democratic Party Chair Nikki Freed spoke with WFSU just days before the convention. In Florida, registered Republicans outnumber Democrats by a million voters, but Freed and others are hoping they can gain momentum as Harris surges on. I'm Adrian Andrews.
Several political watchers and opinion writers have been panning Governor Ron DeSantis' political performance during Tuesday's primary election. Tristan Wood spoke with one of DeSantis' critics.
One of the biggest losers during Tuesday's primary elections was Governor Ron DeSantis. He lost at least 11 of the school board races he endorsed, won 6, with 6 more headed to a runoff. 2 years ago, 25 of his endorsed school board candidates won. I have with me Nate Monroe, Florida columnist with the USA Today Network. He wrote an op-ed about DeSantis' political standings after the primaries. So, Nate, what does Tuesday's results mean for DeSantis?
I mean, I think in some ways it confirms what a lot of us had already suspected about his tenure as governor, which is that he is a lame duck. This is a guy, as you said in the intro, who had enormous political potency after his reelection 2 years ago, and heading into a presidential campaign. That presidential campaign flamed out. He has ended up endorsing Donald Trump, and he really emerged from that campaign, I think, a very diminished figure, that coinciding with kind of entering the back half of his governorship. I think what we saw was, you know, again, a political figure who just really lacks the potency he did not so long ago.
So how do you think his current diminished status, like you're saying, will impact his sway during the legislative sessions that remain in his tenure?
That is a really good question. The legislature has been surprisingly timid toward the governor's office for several years, and this really even goes back to Rick Scott. The legislature just does not buck at the governor's office the way that it did in kind of a different era of Florida politics. But certainly one lesson that they should be taking away from Tuesday's results, and look, I mean, you touched on the school board races, which, you know, for good reason, that those have become cultural battlegrounds, but DeSantis's losses extended beyond school board races. There were appointees of his who lost reelection in Florida. There was a judge in Baker County he appointed. Baker County is a rural, deeply red county just outside Jacksonville. Donald Trump won this county with like more than 80% of the vote. It's one of the most Republican areas in the state. DeSantis's appointed judge lost the election to an assistant public defender. In St. John's County, another deeply red part of Northeast Florida, a former official in the DeSantis administration running with DeSantis's endorsement lost a Republican primary for a state House seat. I mean, this kind of stuff happened all across Florida, which is a very long way of saying legislators can certainly take away from this that DeSantis's imprint on a race is, I would say, at best, kind of a non-factor. There is no political reason to be afraid of the governor.
So there are some education-related stories in Florida recently, specifically the books being thrown out at New College of Florida, and former University of Florida President Ben Sass doing exorbitant spending before he resigned, that have garnered national attention to DeSantis higher education appointees. What's your main takeaway from those situations?
You know, the Richard Corcoran at New College and Ben Sass at the University of Florida, they shared commonalities as university presidents. The obvious one being, these are politicians. And although that's not unprecedented, it signaled a kind of change in the way that the college system under DeSantis was looking at who it wanted to run these schools. It felt like a real turn away from the kind of traditional, deeply experienced higher education administrators to politicians. And not surprisingly, politicians do politician-y things. Corcoran and Sass have been lightning rods for criticism. Sass was greeted by protests the day he arrived at UF. He wrote caustic op-eds in the Wall Street Journal and sort of seemed to really relish presenting himself as a kind of alternative to the leadership at Ivy League schools. Richard Corcoran kind of does much the same at New College. He has been proudly converting that liberal arts school into a very kind of explicit conservative learning institution. And so they've just been lightning rods for criticism. And these two storylines, I think, kind of illustrate the perils of appointing politicians to these kinds of jobs.
All right. Thank you so much, Nate, for your time. And
yeah,
good luck with your work.
Yeah, thanks, man. Thanks for reaching out. This is fun.
That was Tristan Wood speaking with USA Today Network columnist Nate Monroe. Voter turnout in Florida for the primary election was the lowest it's been in at least a decade. Any interest in the presidential race did not translate into more voters casting ballots in local and state elections this week. WLRN's Tom Hudson and Christine DeMatte take a look at the numbers.
Turnout was about 20%. How does that compare to previous primary elections?
4 out of 5 eligible voters here in Florida did not cast a ballot in the August primary. turnout fell to a decade low. Now, preliminary data indicates just 22.4% of registered voters, Chris, participated in the primary election season. That's the lowest turnout during a presidential election year since 2012. Barry University political science professor Sean Foreman thinks Florida voters are just tired.
Well, I think the people of Florida have election fatigue. We vote in a presidential primary in March. We vote in municipal elections in different months. We vote in the general election in November. So when you stick this Florida primary in August, it's just bound to get less attention.
Florida is a closed primary state. Voters have to register with a political party to vote in that party's primary. How have voter registration numbers changed?
Well, heading into this August primary, Republicans had overtaken Democrats with voter registration statewide. While Democrats hold the lead of registered voters here in South Florida, the statewide gains in signups by Republicans is mirrored regionally. Here's Sean Foreman again with Barry University.
In the time of Ron DeSantis and his two elections, the Republican Party has been very active in registering voters and making sure they get out to vote. And that's had an impact throughout the state, even in South Florida. Even if Democrats hold an advantage, it's been cut into by larger numbers of Republican voters.
Almost 45,000 new Republican voters registered in South Florida between January and July. Democrats lost almost 4,000 voters during that same time. And minor political parties and NPAs grew by another 31,000. So the growth in the number of registered voters is due thanks to Republicans and independent voters, not Democrats.
Between Election Day, 2 weeks of early voting, and vote-by-mail ballots, how did people cast their ballots this election?
Most voters voted before Election Day this year. That continues a trend we've seen. The number of early voters increased by about 100,000 statewide, driven entirely by more Republicans taking advantage of early voting days. And about half of all votes were cast again by vote-by-mail ballots.
And how does that compare to years past?
Yeah, it's roughly the same. It was higher in 2020 thanks to the height of the COVID-19 pandemic then. But the number of people using vote-by-mail ballots and turning them in dropped a lot from 4 years ago. So did the number of people requesting those ballots in their mailboxes.
Florida law for requesting a vote-by-mail ballot changed a couple of years ago. Tom, what's been the impact?
Big changes. The law canceled all existing vote-by-mail requests after the 2022 election. That change requires voters now to make new requests if they want a ballot in their mailbox every calendar year. The change was largely seen as an effort by Republicans to erode a method of voting where Democrats had had an edge in turnout. And it has worked, Chris. Almost 2 million Florida Democrats requested vote-by-mail ballots for the 2020 primary election. Barely half that number asked for their ballots that way this primary. Republicans also saw a pretty steep drop-off in vote-by-mail requests compared to 4 years ago, though smaller than the fall-off for Democrats.
Now, Tom, will the lower turnout for this primary necessarily translate into lower voter participation for the presidential election?
Well, I'd say Florida voters have shown very little interest in casting ballots this election cycle thus far. Much of that disinterest may be due to what had been a foregone conclusion to the presidential candidates before July. The Florida Democratic Party canceled its March presidential preference primary after President Joe Biden was the sole qualifying candidate. Republicans did hold a primary, overwhelmingly voting for former President Donald Trump. However, barely one out of five eligible GOP voters actually turned out for that spring primary. 4 years ago, it was one in three Florida voters who were registered as a Republican or a Democrat took part in the presidential preference primary.
That's WLRN's Tom Hudson. Thanks, Tom.
Thank you, Chris.
I'm Christine DiMatte.
Coming up on Capitol Report, we'll have the second and final story in our series about the impact of Florida's new abortion restrictions.
Especially with 6 weeks right now, you're kind of working against time. You don't have time to even get that money.
And the Olympics are over, but the Paralympics start next week. We'll hear from a world champion swimmer who's heading to the Paralympic Games for the first time.
My teammate Ellie Marks, she jokes that it's like the Paralympics has been trying to pull me in for years and years.
Okay. Getting an abortion can cost hundreds, if not thousands, of dollars, especially if the patient has to travel to get the procedure. There are groups that can help, for one, but demand for their assistance has soared since Florida's 6-week abortion ban started in May. Advocates tell WUSF Stephanie Colombini they need more money. She spent the day with one of them to learn more.
Bree Wallace is glued to her laptop in a home office covered with abortion rights posters. She works for the Tampa Bay Abortion Fund and spends her days messaging with pregnant clients who need her help paying for care, and fast.
Someone did just text and say that they're currently at a clinic and needing help, so I'm just kind of getting back to them and seeing how much they need, what's going on.
A woman was reaching out from the waiting room of an abortion clinic. She couldn't pay for her appointment. Within minutes, Wallace committed to help. All the woman had to do was share her first name and last initial. She could move forward with her appointment, and the clinic would charge the fund for the balance. It was $490.
It can be pretty hefty for people.
Abortions in Florida usually cost around $600 to $800 during the first trimester. Medicaid and some private insurance plans don't cover it here, so many people pay out of pocket. With a 6-week ban in place, if they do realize they're pregnant in time, they often have just days to act if they want an abortion. Wallace says that can be a hard enough decision to make so quickly, and money adds more stress.
Especially with 6 weeks right now, you're kind of working against time. You don't have time to even get that money.
Abortions have declined in Florida under the 6-week ban, but so far thousands are still being performed each month. And Wallace says some patients who could have saved up their own money if they had more time now need the fund's help. Many people don't even realize they're pregnant by 6 weeks. Since most nearby states also ban abortion, people have to travel to places like Washington, D.C. or Illinois to get care. Between last-minute airfare and hotel stays, Wallace says it can easily cost another $1,000.
But of course, there's also taking off work that can be hard for people, finding childcare. Sometimes this is the first time people have ever been on a plane, ever left Florida.
Just 12 days into July, the Tampa Bay Abortion Fund had to pause paying for travel costs for the month in order to prioritize people needing appointments in Florida. The group relies on donations and grants and had set a $50,000 a month budget to avoid running out of money. They spent that much in about 2 weeks. Wallace says she and board members are having tough conversations about the future.
I think money is always going to be an issue, unfortunately. I think we're still spending a lot, and with funding cuts, are really getting hit harder than that.
Those cuts she's referring to involve the National Abortion Federation. It's a professional association for abortion providers that also runs a hotline to help patients with funding. The group used to cover half the appointment cost for patients who qualify for aid. They cut that down to 30% in July. Wallace says local funds are having to fill the gap.
It has been hurting us quite a bit with budget.
The decision to reduce subsidy rates was heartbreaking, says Federation President Brittany Fontenot. But she says demand for help around the country has been overwhelming. During the first half of this year, Fontenot says the hotline was spending more than $6 million a month on abortion appointments and thousands more on travel. And even more people have needed help with out-of-state care since Florida's ban went into effect.
If we had kept pace with our previous level of spending, we would have run out of funds by the fall.
Both local and national funds say they haven't been getting as many donations as they did when Roe v. Wade was first overturned. Many funds have to pause services when they reach their spending limits, often towards the end of each month. Amber Pugh with the National Abortion Hotline says that can be the most challenging time to hear from patients.
It's very difficult to hear the desperation in people that they just want to get the healthcare that they need. We will always do our best, but sometimes we can't help everyone.
Pugh says funds work closely together and often chip in money to support each other.
Okay. I did that case all day.
The day I shadowed Bree Wallace with the Tampa Bay Abortion Fund, a woman reached out who was 11 weeks pregnant. She needed help getting to D.C. for an abortion. The fund could pay for the appointment, but had already paused travel support. Wallace tapped the national hotline, and an hour later, learned they'd cover the flight and hotel.
So happy about that. Happy that the travel is all covered, so now this person's all good.
Wallace says the fund ended up spending more than $100,000 last month, double their budget. That helped 232 people get abortions, including one woman who texted this to Wallace.
Thank you with a million exclamation points. Thank you so much with even more exclamation points. I appreciate you for what you do. You just help me more than you know.
Wallace knows the fund could run out of money if donations don't replenish their reserves. But with so much need right now, she says it's a chance they'll have to take. I'm Stephanie Colombini in Tampa.
Some Republican lawmakers are getting kind of critical about a controversial proposal to add lodges, pickleball courts, and golf at state parks, as Governor Ron DeSantis' office on Thursday defended the idea of making the sites more visitor-friendly. The Florida Department of Environmental Protection this week announced the plan, dubbed the Great Outdoors Initiative, and said 8 meetings would be held on Tuesday of next week to review management plans for 9 parks from Miami-Dade County to the Panhandle. Environmental groups quickly criticized the initiative and were joined on Thursday by Republican lawmakers, including Senate President Kathleen Passidomo, who is a chief proponent of creating a statewide wildlife corridor. Senator Jay Trumbull, a Panama City Republican whose Northwest Florida district includes 3 of the targeted state parks, called the proposal unnecessary development. You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, the Olympics were by many accounts a hit, but the 2024 Paris Games aren't over yet. The Paralympics start next week, and former Florida State University swimmer Christy Raleigh Crossley will be among the competitors. Regan McCarthy spoke with the athlete, who says her business card reads, CRC, World Champion.
I am the reigning world champion in backstroke, and I am the world record holder in the 50 backstroke. But of my 4 events that I'm swimming in Paris, the 100 backstroke is my least favorite. My favorite event is the 100 butterfly.
Wow, I'm so impressed by people who swim butterfly. I think it's so hard.
Yeah, no, I was 5 years old, the story is, I was at practice one day and we were doing freestyle and I was just doing the whole practice butterfly. And my coach, her name is Heidi, she said, Christy, why are you doing butterfly? And according to the legend, I said, well, 2 arms are easier than 1. It's funny because now the same thing holds true, is that because of my disability being hemispheric, so affecting the left side, being able to do a stroke that both sides are doing it at the same time is actually a lot easier on me neurologically, because I'm not trying to make the other arm do something while, you know, my good arm is doing something else. This way they just work together and it's just like follow the leader.
And is it okay if I ask you about your injuries?
Yeah, sure. So my teammate Ellie Marks, she jokes that it's like the Paralympics has been trying to pull me in for years and years. When I was at Florida State, I actually was in a car accident involving a drunk driver where we were rear-ended, and I herniated several discs in my spine, and that kind of started the spine instability that I currently have. We don't know if that contributed to the spinal cord issues that I currently have, but obviously it didn't help. So in 2008, after I had left Florida State, well, I was still there as a student, but after I had stopped swimming, I was hit by a car as a pedestrian and I came down on my head. And they believe that that impact started to grow what's called a hemangioma in my brain. Cavernous hemangioma is what killed the runner Flojo. Hers ruptured in her sleep and she passed away. So we think that that started in 2008 and we had no idea that it was growing. And in 2018, I was hit in the head while on a ski trip. I was hit in the head with like a block of ice. and it caused a bleed of the brain of that hemangioma. And I ended up temporarily paralyzed from it. And so actually I called football player Myron Roll, who, as you probably know, is a neurosurgeon. We were very good friends while we were at our time in Florida State. I called up Myron and he was like, listen, I would do brain surgery. He explained the brain surgery to me. And he said, if you can't get it done at NYU, come up to Harvard. We'll do it here for you. But I ended up being able to get the surgery done at NYU. And so they removed the tumor from my brain, the blood tumor. And but it left, because it had been growing for so long and killing the brain as it grew. And then the margins, I have margins of dead brain around where they removed that from. And so having that brain injury and subsequent brain surgery to remove it, I've been left with what's called hemipariasis or hemiplegia, which is weakness of one side of the body. So my left side is affected because my brain injury was on the right. I also have what's called ataxia, which is coordination issues on that left side. And then most recently, last year, I was diagnosed with dystonia. So I'll have periodic tightness of the muscles, but also mine is dynamic induced. So when I do repetitive motions like swimming, my muscles tighten up and lock. So when I finish a race, my arm is always like in a contorted manner where it's just like the muscles are stuck in a spasm. And so it's like, it looks like a contracture of the limb, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Fortunately though, you know, I had so many years before my brain injury to like, for my body to have this like muscle memory of like how to swim. And I do have the right side that's really good at doing things and really strong. So we adapt and we, you know, we figure it out.
Yeah, because being an Olympic swimmer has been a goal of yours since you were pretty young, right?
Yeah, since the 96 Olympics, watching Beth Bosford, I had met her before the games and watching her win, you know, her golds, I was just like, that's what I want to do. I want to be an Olympian. And, you know, it just never happened. There was always something that came up each cycle, each quad. So now for this to finally happen, you know, parallel to the Olympics, which is what, you know, the Paralympics is, it's parallel to. I do think that on this platform, I'll be able to do a lot more good than I ever could have done as Christy the Olympian, you know, so Christy the Paralympian can, you know, raise awareness for other people who are going through things. You know, life happens how it's supposed to happen. And yeah, I'm very excited to finally be able to, you know, represent Team USA.
That was Paralympian Christy Raleigh Crossley speaking with reporter Regan McCarthy. You can hear more of their interview on WFSU's new show, Speaking Of. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Adrian Andrews, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, Margie Menzel, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Tom Hudson, Christine DeMonte, and Stephanie Colombini. Technical support for Capitol Report comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. We hope you'll join us again next week on air and online for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.